I will open with a word of prayer and we'll get started. Father, we are thankful to be here together with our church family, and regardless of the circumstances, we know that you are sovereign and have that trust in you. And thank you for the opportunity to fellowship, to worship, to study, and to learn the things that you have for us this morning, and also to enjoy the time together in prayer and worship and all those things. We pray that we might do it to your glory. In Christ's name we pray. Amen. This morning we are looking at 30 Years' War. I don't know if any of you are familiar with it, if you ever heard of it. Obviously, we mentioned it last week that hopefully by today's class you'll know all kinds of things about it. So the 30 Years' War went from 1618 to 1648, ranks as one of the most devastating conflicts ever to ravage the soil of Europe. That's quite a statement there. But it's true. And unfortunately for Germany, the war was fought on German soil. So Germany took the biggest hit on this thing. Because Germany, this was the Holy Roman Empire. The core of it was Germany as we know it today. And virtually all the major European powers became involved in the clash at one time or another, so that Germany became an international battleground where marauding armies inflicted destruction on each other, on the civilian population, and on the land. And this was one of those wars where the armies weren't just shooting at each other. I mean, they were, but they would ravage the cities and the land. In many cases, the soldiers weren't able to get their pay, and they were stuck there, and so they would just take it out of the land and out of the people and take what they wanted. And so being in a land where this kind of war was being fought was rough on everybody, not just the soldiers. 30 Years' War is thought to have claimed between 4 to 12 million lives. That's quite a range, I realize, but it's hard to go back and put a number on it, because almost 450,000 died in combat. So think about that. That's half, you know, less than half a million, they're saying, died in combat. What did the other, all the others die from? Disease, famine, took a lion's share of death, of the death toll. People were not growing crops a lot of time because there was too much danger. You know that, you know how that works in the ancient world. You had a walled city, and then you would have people living outside the city who had their farmland and so forth. And a lot of times people just drew up and came inside the city walls, and they weren't out there able to tend to their crops or whatnot. So this eventually leads to famine. If you're not taking care of your farm, you ain't got food, and then you got soldiers coming and taking it. And then you've got disease. It's ugly. It's very ugly. Estimates suggest that 20% of Europe's people perish. With some areas, the population falls as much as 60%. Imagine 60% of your country dying. That's just unreal. Even 20, I mean, think about that. I know we think COVID's a big deal, but something like this is really, really tough. It's a very, very, very tough war. The war was religious in origin. In origin. And we're going to find out that it shifts as it goes along, which is another thing that makes this war somewhat unique and interesting. And it's a transitional war in history. A lot of things about this war make it very pivotal. Because, you know, there have been a lot of wars that we haven't covered in class, but I just thought this one, first of all, it marks the end of the era, and it's such a big war. But the other thing is just the impact that it had in so many ways that I just didn't see how we couldn't look at it. So we could regard it in many ways as part two of the religious civil war between Protestants and Roman Catholics that flared across Germany from 1547 to 1552. So you have Luther in 1517. You've got Lutheranism beginning to spread. Now you've got wars going on between Catholics and Lutherans within Germany. And that got worked out early on. And that war culminated in what they called the Peace of Augsburg, where they met to come to the terms of peace, ratified by the German Imperial Diet. The peace generally accomplished its objective, that first one, the one at Augsburg. It really did bring peace to most of Germany, most of the time, for about 60 years. That's a pretty good peace accord. Its fatal defect was It gave legal recognition only to two forms of Christianity, Roman Catholicism and Lutheranism, because Calvinism, while it was in existence and coming into being at that point, it wasn't playing a big role in Germany at that point, so it wasn't covered under the terms of the agreement. The agreement was hashed out between the Lutherans and the Catholics. The Reformed faith, which at that point had almost no presence in Germany, was not covered by the peace. Calvinism, however, enjoyed major growth in Germany after the peace was signed. So once that treaty was signed and went into effect, Calvinism continued to grow. Remember Calvin's efforts down in Geneva and Switzerland? They were sending out missionaries and spreading. So they began to encroach into Germany. Numerous German territories embraced or extended toleration to the Reformed faith after 1555. So even though the agreement didn't cover it, in fact, technically they were violating imperial law since the Peace of Augsburg had outlawed any faith except Catholicism and Lutheranism. So they worked out a deal between the Lutherans and the Catholics and said, okay, we're going to be at peace with each other, but nobody else gets to be included. Anybody else comes along, like they were probably thinking of the Anabaptists, off with their heads. Only these two. Well, then, the Reformed faith began to grow, and technically, formally, they should have been put to death, but they weren't, because they were like, well, these guys are Christians. And it wasn't Calvinism alone that provoked friction in Germany. Lutherans and Catholics, although legally protected by the Peace of Augsburg, did not necessarily live at peace with each other. As we know, peace agreements aren't perfect. So even the Catholics and the Lutherans had a little bit of fighting going on. So there was a period of general peace, but there was some disruption going on. And it was especially disruptive was the idea that the Calvinism was moving in and they weren't covered by this. So there was a potential powder keg being formed here that was going to explode. And particularly in Bohemia, there were Lutherans and Calvinists, indeed, in 1575. And who do we know as the great figure in Bohemia, the great pre-reformed leader that we looked at?
Hus.
So we had all these Hussites. You remember Bohemia successfully repelled the Catholics back then. It was after Hus was put to death, but his teachings and his legacy carried on, and it was very entrenched there. And so in Bohemia, the Hussites had signed an agreement with the Protestant joint Protestant confession of faith, the Bohemian Confession, as a way of acting together politically to secure freedom of worship. So the Lutherans and the Calvinists and the Hussites, they had their differences, but in Bohemia they were getting along, okay, because their beliefs were a lot of overlap there, a lot of similarity, even though we never could bring Luther on board, remember, with Calvin. The followers of those guys recognized that we have a lot in common here, a lot more in common than we have with the Catholics. The king of Bohemia, and in fact of the Holy Roman Empire, was none other than the Holy Roman Emperor, Catholic Habsburg, Rudolf II. Now, the Habsburg family was a very powerful, well-known family in this time. Charles V was a Habsburg, for example. And they were pretty much made up the monarchy of the Holy Roman Empire for a number of years. And the Holy Roman Empire centered in Germany, but it had strong holdings in Spain. It had some holdings in southern Italy. We'll see this on a map in a minute. And then we had some holdings in the Netherlands, which is just right up to the northwest of Germany. Nevertheless, we have this Holy Roman Empire who's Catholic, and he is technically an authority over Bohemia, which has got this agreement between Lutherans, Calvinists, and Hussites, none of which are Catholic. So there's a little bit of tension there, as you might imagine. The Habsburgs added Bohemia to their Europe-wide dynastic empire in 1526, so they added them in early on, but there was still, again, some tension there in terms of religion. Despite Rudolf's animosity toward the Reformation, the Bohemian Protestant nobility forced him in 1609 to recognize their liberty in a document known as the Letter of Majesty. And you see this in history at various times, where a king is forced to sign an agreement that he's not going to exert his power in a certain way in terms of religious freedom or in terms of other liberties, perhaps. In this case, their obvious concern is that he doesn't, this Catholic monarch or emperor doesn't come in and squash the religious freedoms that they enjoy in Bohemia. They got him to sign this agreement for whatever that's worth. The next emperor, Matthias, who was childless, so the one guy signed the agreement, but he passed off the scene. We got a new guy comes on the scene. He didn't have any kids, so he has to pick a successor, and he had his cousin, the Archduke Ferdinand of Styria, which is Lower Austria, presented to the Bohemian nobility in 1617 as their crown prince and future king. So this guy comes in, he's a new guy, he doesn't have any heirs, so he's going to name his heir his cousin. And he said, this is going to be your future king, Bohemia. And they were about as happy about that as a lot of Christians were about Joe Biden becoming president. It's like, what? We don't want that guy. No, we don't. A shiver of dread ran through the country. Why? Because Ferdinand, this guy that was presented as your up-and-coming king, was an aggressive counter-reformation Catholic, having received brilliant Jesuit training. We know about Jesuit training, right? The Jesuits were all about anti-reformation stuff. He had brutally suppressed Protestantism in his own land of Styria. The Bohemians couldn't expect much better. And they're saying, you're kidding me. That guy is going to be over us? We don't want him. And already in the 1609 Letter of Majesty, the one document protecting them, they thought, from the Catholic rulers, was proving ineffective at stopping Emperor Matthias, you know, the second guy, in Bohemia from harassing his Protestants. So already Matthias was seeming to ignore the agreement that the previous emperor had signed. And now this new guy comes along who's a staunch Jesuit and has a track record of being really, really hard on Protestants. And they're going, no. Mm-mm. The fear of what so intolerant a Catholic as Ferdinand might do as their new king drove the Bohemian nobility to outright rebellion. And so a band of nobles busted some windows and broke into the capital while they were meeting to... Oh, wait a minute, I read that wrong. A band of nobles bribed their way into the Prague castle where four Ferdinand's representatives were meeting, and the nobles threw two of the unfortunate men, well-known and flexible Catholics, out the third floor window, and they landed unharmed in a pile of horse dung. Now imagine if that had happened at the Capitol. That would have given them something to talk about. Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer got thrown out the window into a pile of horse dung. It might have been interesting. So this is kind of their version of that. It was May 18, 1618. And this was known as this is a new word I learned this week, defenestration of Prague. And defenestration is the act of throwing someone out a window. Now you learned a new word. It's a bizarre word. But throwing unpopular politicians out of windows was a Bohemian tradition, almost a sport. It's like, who knew? It is this melodramatic event that marks the outbreak of the 30 Years' War. This is what lit the match. It's very interesting to me. I mean, wars get started for the craziest things, right? What did World War I start from? The assassination of the Archduke Ferdinand of Austria, right? So, Ferdinand, that's a familiar name. These wars, you know, just some event that seems kind of insignificant compared to what the whole thing started. It's like it lights a match, you know, and then suddenly you got a bonfire, you got a house fire, you got the whole town's on fire. And that's kind of what happened here. So this tension over Bohemia and over this new guy, and then throwing these guys out the window into the horse dung, that kicked off a whole war that lasted 30 years. And so I just kind of throw up a map here of Europe as it looks. And again, the major players here, you've got they call it Habsburg or Habsburgs, I guess different ways of spelling it, but they've got holdings in, mostly they're centered here in the area that we know as Germany today, right? And there's Austria and some other places, or Czechoslovakia today, but anyways, mostly this is Germany here. Notice all the little tiny breakup little regions? That's because it was a confederation of a bunch of of nobles who all had control, and they all were under the emperor, but they were broken up into little territories within that, which created some room for tension and some difficulty, because if some of those guys who had those little areas decided to get together and band together against the emperor, then he had to contend with that. So that was Germany. And then over here you see the Habsburg had holdings in Spain. They have holdings in southern Italy and the Netherlands. And then, of course, your other big players are, you got France here, and we're going to see some people coming down from the north again pretty soon. Of course, there's England out here. They don't play a role in the 30 Years' War so much. So anyway, by November 1618, the Bohemian rebels had quelled internal resistance to their revolution and were in full military control of the country. So they booted out anybody that was going to try to bring Catholicism in. They took full control. And the initial success of the Bohemian Revolt led to serious Protestant uprisings against Catholic rulers throughout the entire region. Moravia, Silesia, Upper Austria, Transylvania, even Archduke Ferdinand's Styria. So when a rebellion succeeds in one area, it can kind of give some courage to some other areas that were thinking about, they had problems anyway. Say, hey, these guys managed to throw off the yoke. Let's see if we can do it. So a lot of times, when something happens in one place, others are looking on, and it, you know, these people hope to serve as kind of an example. In August 1619, the Bohemians elected a new king as the Calvinist Prince Frederick V, and he was the leader of the Protestant Union. Frederick's acceptance touched off fighting between Catholics and Calvinists. The Catholics were like, all right, we ain't having this. So in 1620, interestingly enough, the year that the pilgrims came to America, this was going on here, near Prague, the Catholic imperial forces surged forward to the cry for the Virgin Mary and crushed the Bohemians and confiscated most of the estates of the insurgents. So a very quick, momentarily successful rebellion ended up getting crushed by a Catholic force that came in. And the victors added salt to the wounds by awarding the Jesuits control of the University of Prague, the old haunt of John Huss. Now, that, you talk about an insult, you know. Here you have this university that is following in teachings of John Huss and has perpetuated his teachings and education, and then the Jesuits come in and take it over. Ugly stuff happens in war, folks. Appalled by this Catholic victory and eager to annex German territory, King Christian IV, interesting name, of Lutheran Denmark, that's all the way up north, entered the war against Ferdinand and the Catholic forces. Without adequate support, however, his venture was doomed from the start. In 1626, the Danes were completely routed in Harz Mountains and forced to withdraw to Denmark like a pack of whipped pups. So at first it looked like, you know, hey, we can't have this. He was incensed by what was happening to his fellow Protestants. And there was always a certain amount, throughout this war, there's a certain amount of resentment of the Habsburgs. It just is. The Habsburgs are a big, threatening force, and a lot of people aren't real crazy about them. And the Danes were among those, but they weren't able to do anything about it. They went off kind of half-cocked and didn't do so well. However, help then arrived from another quarter. In 1611, when he was only 17 years old, Gustavus Adolphus had inherited the Swedish throne. Has anybody heard of a Gustavus Adolphus? I've heard that name before. Yeah, he's a well-known king and general ruler. Since Gustavus Adolphus was also a staunch Lutheran, remember Lutheranism had moved up to the Norwegian countries, and they were mostly Lutheran. He was a staunch Lutheran who bewailed the events that were taking place in Bohemia, just like the Danes did. And he felt compelled to intervene with the double purpose, one, defending Protestants. He hated seeing his fellow Protestants treated like they were, and he wanted to come in to their aid. And also, defeating the ambitions of the Habsburgs. He was not a fan of the Habsburg anyways. So he thought, you know, this is a chance for me to gain some territory, and this is a chance for me to put the knock the Habsburg back on their heels, and also to protect my fellow Protestants. So he begins to move. And in 1630, he invaded Germany And at first, the Swedes found little support among the German Protestants, who feared the emperor's wrath, and in any case did not trust the Swedish invader. I mean, you'd have to think, you know, I don't know what to think about this guy. No matter what you think about the Habsburgs, who's this guy? He's coming in with his army, and he didn't get a lot of trust or support at first. But Gustavus Adolphus was a very able general, and whose repeated victories soon became legendary. So he was known as a really great general. He was very capable militarily. But not only that, his soldiers, in contrast to all the armies that had marched in this protracted war, treated the native population with kindness and respect. And that made a big difference. So it's one thing if an army comes through and they're going to ravage, you know, take your crops, take your women, take, you know, I mean, just the kind of things the armies were doing. And then you have an army that comes through and they treat the civilian population with kindness and respect. They're coming in, they're advancing militarily, but they treat the people with respect. Now that began to catch people's attention because this was a contrast to what the other armies had done. And while the Swedes were clearly Protestant, they did not force the conversion of Catholics in areas that they conquered. This is also unusual. In this day and age, back here, you know, when you were conquered, you had to accept the religion of the new conquerors. And the Swedish guys were like, no, you don't have to become Protestant just because we are. Repeatedly, Gustavus Adolphus made it clear he did not seek to dismember Germany for Swedish profit. That was not his primary motive. When France offered him financial support in his campaign against the Habsburgs, he accepted it on the condition it be understood that not a single village in the German territory would become French. He says, great, if you want to give me some financial help, I could use it. But understand something, I'm not going to change the way I deal with people. And just because France, you're contributing, doesn't mean you get to have some territory in Germany. That's not going to happen under my watch. Eventually, several powerful German Protestant princes came to his support as the Germans began to realize this guy's not a bad guy. We might like him better than the Habsburgs. So they joined up forces and helped him out as he was coming into the land and gaining territory. Gustavus Adolphus then sent some of his German allies to invade Bohemia. That's where this whole thing started, back to the starting place. And by then, several Catholic leaders were suing for peace. They're like, whoa, 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 enough. No mas. And many were willing to agree to the terms imposed by the Swedish king. I mean, he was beginning to show himself, and better to sue for peace than to face the wrath of the guy who's coming in, who's not going to be very kind to you if you try to fight him. And his conditions were simple. Religious tolerance for both Catholics and Protestants. He had a big belief in religious tolerance. And he's already shown that by his own actions. The restoration of the ancient rights to the kingdom of Bohemia. He wants to restore the Bohemians back to their original beliefs and their rights and their lands. And he wants to expel the Jesuits. The Jesuits are bad news, and everybody knows that. And he wants them expelled. No more Jesuits. Well, that looked like it was going to go well, but then the Spanish Habsburgs sent an army to support their cousins in Germany. So now he just about tipped this way, and another group comes in and tips it the other way. Another cavalry comes over the hill from the other side. You know, this is why this war kept going on for 30 years. It's just one domino after another, you know, coming in. And in the meantime, this is really surprising, the French joined in support of the Protestants, even though France was then ruled by a cardinal of the Roman Catholic Church. This is unheard of. Normally, Catholics would come in and support Catholics. But the hatred for the Habsburg and the distrust or the animosity toward the Habsburgs by the French was so intense, they preferred to fight alongside Protestants against the Habsburg than to fight for Catholicism. That was different. And that really changed the whole... Remember I said the war started as a religious war? Well, now it's not exactly a religious war. Now it's more of a political war, more of a power struggle. But eventually, even the most bloodthirsty, tired of war and destruction, and some things, you know, started to take place. Ferdinand the second had died in 1637. His son and successor, Ferdinand III, although a sincere Catholic, did not share his father's intolerance, so he wasn't as zealous as his dad about, you know, killing Protestants. Germans bemoan seeing their land invaded by foreign troops in support of both sides. They're just tired of, we get tired of war real quick. Sweden was ready to withdraw its army. They had been away for a long time. Gustavus actually got killed in one of the battles. I didn't mention that here, but, and so that kind of, they still won the battle, I think, but they lost one of their great guys. So that hurt. And France saw this as an opportunity. They said, hey, you know, everybody's ready to come to the table. Maybe we can get a piece of the pie here. Because they were one of the big players at that point. So when the contending powers finally met in the German province of Westphalia in 1648 in order to end the bloodshed, the balance of power in Europe had radically changed. Spain had lost not only the Netherlands, but its dominant position in Western Europe. Because Spain had been a big player up to this point. But, you know, they hung it in there as, you know, in support of the Habsburg, and the Habsburg took a big hit in this war because so many other people had ganged up against them. France was now the chief Western power. This is where France begins to go on the rise. Sweden had control of the Baltic, the sea up there in the north. We'll show you again on the map in a minute. They gained some territory that they hadn't had before, and they had a stronger hold on the Baltic. United Netherlands was recognized as an independent republic instead of being under the thumb of Spain. And the German member states of the Holy Roman Empire were granted full sovereignty. So one of the things that Gustavus granted and the others coming in, they just took those little tiny territories that we saw on the map and each having their own little rule and said, you guys are all individually sovereign. You don't have to listen to the big guy. Well, that's a good way to keep the big guy in check by giving the little guys power to rule their own little domains. And so here's basically the same map, but it's 30 years later. And kind of the big picture things to notice is Sweden. Notice how much Sweden has picked up territory right here into the German area. And notice France over here coming in from this side picked up a lot of territory. So Germany was being subdivided by the invaders. And, of course, again, they had given a lot of autonomy to the local rulers. Then the Netherlands had gained some independence as well. So there was a lot of shifting going on as a result of this war over 30 years. The terms of peace, called the Peace of Westphalia, 1648, reflect the passing of an age. Calvinism joined Lutheranism and Catholicism as a recognized expression of the Christian faith. So now we have an agreement between Catholics and Lutherans and Calvinists. However, the Anabaptists, the poor Anabaptists, are still left out. They were not included. Princes, if they chose, could for the first time allow Protestants and Catholics to exist within their territories. It used to be, you know, you were either a Catholic territory or you were a Lutheran territory, or you were, but they said, no, we're going to have a multicultural society, so to speak. The Pope was excluded from any interference in the religious affairs of Germany. The Pope had been, you know, pulling strings from Italy for the longest time. And they said, nope, no more Pope. And of course, naturally, Pope Innocent X condemned the treaty, but both Catholics and Protestants just ignored his protests. They said, you're no longer a player, pal. You're out. And the state was now free to transact its business as though the Pope did not exist. That's a first in Germany. Christianity's alliance with civil power was changing. Christians in the West now live in nation states, and nation states were the real victor in the 30 Years' War. This is when individual nation states, instead of the big empire under the big control or the Pope or what have you, now you have a lot of small independent nation states forming, each having their own independent power. And the emerging nation states would require Christians to live under a government whose citizens belong to a variety of denominations and faiths. So there's a lot of interdenominational business going on. In time, some of these nation states required citizens to affirm a generic version of God in order to hold office or attend college, but distinctive beliefs and practices, such as being Catholic or Presbyterian, were strictly a private individual matter. So we see a real strong shifting away from this compulsion to believe what the leader believes, and everybody be all lined up together. And if you don't, you know, off with your head type of thing. And now, they're, as long as they, it appears from this statement that they still expected people to have a generic belief in God of some kind. You had to be a Catholic or something. I don't think they were looking for atheists or devil worshipers. But nevertheless, there was a much wider tolerance for a wide variety of beliefs within government, within the colleges, and within the citizenry. Because of these developments in the 30 Years' War, it is considered to be the last great religious war. It started as a religious war. And after that, it seems that wars in the future were not about religion. They were about territorial political power. The way its nature had been secularized by the Catholic France fighting alongside Protestants against Catholic Habsburgs meant that a new, more pragmatic era had dawned in European history. So now, largely influenced by what the French did, it's no longer a Catholic-Protestant thing. It's more of a, hey, this guy likes the Habsburg, this guy doesn't kind of thing. Nations would now be much more ready to fight for their own interest and glory without a convincing religious motive. So we don't have the big, we've been watching all this time the Crusades and all these different religious and holy wars that were being fought. And the era for holy wars was, this was it. It's now over. So really a major, major shift. And you can see the effects of this in modern day Europe. I mean, how this has played out, right? This is really a huge impact, this war. Well, folks, that wraps up the Reformation. Remember, we started this class breaking church history into four major segments. And again, this is somewhat arbitrary, but there's reasons for all of it. So I broke it up into the early church, which goes from the death of Christ all the way up to, who was that Pope? That's 600 AD. I forget his name already. See, I got to go back and review my own class. So it goes, it's to 600. And then from 600 to 1517 was considered the medieval church. Of course, 1517 is Luther. Then from 1517 to the end of a 30 Years' War, 1638, is kind of the period we designate as the Reformation. So at this point, we're kind of moving beyond the Reformation into the, quote, modern church. And that's modern in quotes because, you know, modern, we're still talking, could include the late 17th century, you know. But the church made a major shift because of this 30 Years' War. All of politics made a major shift. And so the flavor of churches and empires and countries are now different than they ever have been prior to that time. And that takes us into the modern era. So next time we'll kind of do a quick kind of helicopter flyby view in the beginning of class to kind of just bring to mind a few more of the details. We won't go back into everything, obviously. But we'll just bring to mind some of the high points of history. And I'll try to give you a little bit of a forecast of where we're going to be going in modern church history. But we're basically at this point going to be coming in for a landing here in the next several months, trying to wrap things up covering the modern church period and hopefully finish all of church history. That will be exciting. All right, discussion time. Do you see any parallels between some of the events leading up to the 30 Years' War and recent events in our country? If so, what are they? I've kind of tried to make some of those obvious as I saw them, but see if you picked up on any of that. Or if you saw something else. In this war, perhaps more than in previous wars, you see the emergence of a pluralistic religious belief within the population of a single country, something that has been the hallmark of our own nation. Is this a good thing? Is there a point at which such pluralism begins to undermine the ability of a nation to hold together? And if so, what is it? How do you stop it? Now, those are very vague general questions. I admit, and you can go a lot of different directions with this, but I think you see what I'm going for here. You know, we moved historically before the 30 Years' War, you had to be monolithic. Everybody had to be the same religion to, no, tolerance. You know, you can be a Catholic or a Protestant or a Lutheran. Well, now, and that's kind of the hallmark of our country, but now in our country, like you can be a Muslim or a devil worshiper or an atheist or we can really get divergent. Is that a good thing? Is it at some point do we become too tolerant? Or is tolerance a good thing at all? Maybe you want to argue we should go back to the medieval period. Feel free to argue that if you want to. We're told that some of these nation states required citizens to affirm a generic version of God in order to hold office or attend college. But distinctive beliefs and practices, such as being Catholic or Presbyterian, were strictly a private individual matter. Again, that sounds so much like our own country today, I think. This could be still be a pretty accurate description of our nation today. Again, we just look for the most generic. I started to think, you know, you don't even have to be committed to God to be in office. But in a way, it seems like our country still looks for that, right? Joe Biden still wants to claim to be a Catholic, or Nancy Pelosi. She's a good Catholic, you know, when it suits her. And of course, she's really not a good, they're terrible Catholics. They go against historic Catholic doctrines, but hey, you know, generally committed to religion of some sort. So that's why I mean it's still an accurate description to some degree. Still popular to kind of say, I believe in God, I'm religious. Do you think it's enough for an office holder to affirm a generic belief in God? Should we expect more? If so, what? And again, I'm being very vague in my question. You could say, well, expect more legally, or just expect more when we go to the voting booth, or you can answer that any way you want to. I'm just trying to, I had difficulty crafting the questions today, honestly. There was some ideas I was going for, and I don't know if I quite get my finger put on it, but I gave it my best stab, so maybe you can help me out. So that's our questions for today, if you would like to entertain any of those. Lots of ways to go with this.
So didn't we have recently here in Little Rock some big goat-headed statue that somebody wanted to erect?
Yeah, at the Capitol.
Yeah.
Because of the Ten Commandments, you know, they thought they should have their goat head or whatever it was, yeah.
So yeah. We're a representative government, right?
Yeah.
That's kind of what we are. So is there a certain percentage of the people that's got to be a certain something before we erect a goat head or something like that? I mean, to say that there has to be an equal something is, I think, farcical. It just everything shuts down. No, yeah. We don't have to recognize atheists and goat-headed, whatever they are.
Yeah.
Because they are not represented in any significant way in the populace of the people.
That's true.
That's the way I would argue. I don't know what the question that was about how you worded something in there that maybe.
Yeah, that's fine. It doesn't matter. I was trying to get an idea, and I didn't do a very good job of being precise. So you're hitting at some of the ideas that I was kind of wrestling with, too.
Yeah. So we don't have to go look under every, you know, rock and find every weird idea and then represent that in some way in our legal and even in our communal existence in Arkansas. We don't have to do that. What we do is represent the people,
yeah,
of Arkansas with the people that we put into power. And I can see the connection. I can say, okay, you told me the 30 years war when we came in here, and I didn't know when that was going to be. I did not have that as a framework. Okay, when did that happen, and certainly, yeah, what the results were. But you can kind of see from what you presented there how that activity led to a lot of the shaping of the Western
mindset.
Well, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, you can see it.
Yeah, I was stunned by that too, honestly. I mean, I had heard of the 30 Years' War. I knew it was a thing. But until I really delved into the what was behind all that, other than the political, you know, you got all the names and dates and all that. But when you get behind all the names and dates and find out what were the real issues, and I started looking at that and going, wow, this is what shaped a lot of our modern thinking.
And I find it surprising that Gustav or whoever that was that said, we're not going to make one religion illegal. We're going to peacefully coexist like this.
Yeah.
I find that fascinating that the people that did that were the
Swedes.
Were the Christians.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The
Lutheran Christians, I guess.
Yeah. The Lutheran Christians. Gustavus Adolphus.
I could never see that coming from the other side.
Yeah. That was surprising to me, too. And where that came from in his background, I don't know. I didn't look into him that deeply. I've heard the name. I mean, when I saw that name, I thought, oh, I've heard that one. But I didn't know that about what he did. Apparently a huge influence, and obviously I think an influence in our country today. You have to figure this factors in.
Was John F. Kennedy our first Catholic president?
I think he was. It was a big controversy back in the day. I remember it.
Right.
And everybody was like, oh, so the Pope's going to be ruling the United States.
I think that was the big question, how
big of an influence the Vatican has over the White House.
Yeah.
And what kind of, how is he beholden? Could there be excommunication if he breaches something like that, or withheld communion? And because salvation is wrapped up in the Mass and all that, if the Catholic president has upset the Pope, then salvation is on the puppet string, or being dangled over his head in some way. So yeah. I can see where the concern is in that certain religious beliefs being in such a powerful position.
Yeah, I do remember that being a big thing with him, and a big question mark. You know, what's that going to mean? You know, a Catholic guy in office is...
Yeah, and in church history, the story where the emperor is outside in the cold...
Yeah.
Begging the Pope to release that...
Yeah. Yeah, I'm trying to remember who that is, too. I remember the account. I wish I could remember my own lessons. Honestly, we've covered so much stuff, it's hard for me. I have to go back sometimes and go, that's right. I refresh my own memory.
So in recent history, I struggled wondering how we should think about a Mormon president.
Yeah.
Mitt Romney, when he was up to bat. And based on the alternative, you know, I think there's a clear decision there. And yet,
yeah,
I was a cult.
Yeah, I mean, those questions do cross your mind, and they should. I mean, it has to factor in. You think about, so you take even like Trump, there was a lot of concern. I mean, I had concern before he was in office. First of all, I didn't think he was for real. I was thinking, he's just saying all that stuff just to get the votes, you know. But he ended up delivering on such a large number of his promises. He really was the guy he said he was going to be. I would have never guessed that. I was just sure once we elected him, he was going to just become like the liberal. He always had seemed to be, his background seemed to be quite liberal, and especially theologically. I never had any confidence that the guy was a Christian early on. I don't know if later that changed or not. I'm not saying it did. I don't know. But some of the people he was drawn to were some of the strangest people in terms of religion, you know, and what factor should that play in our wanting him to be president? Again, you have to look at the alternative. That's one thing we're always faced with in our own politics. I mean, you've got to look at, okay, yeah, maybe he's not the ideal person, but what's the other choice? And it's all you got. You got two to choose from. You go write some other name in there, and you're just, in my opinion, you're just wasting your vote. So you got to pick from what you got. That's not one of the choices if you wanted something else. Sorry. But as it turns out, Trump was a really decent guy, but in terms of his theology, I've never had a lot of confidence in his...
Well, I've always heard the illustration, you know, if you have brain surgery, you don't need that brain surgeon to be a Christian. You just need to know how to do brain surgery. And yet, leadership requires a moral dimension because you're making moral decisions. Your policy has a moral dimension. So one has to consider the beliefs of the candidate. I just don't know where the line is in terms of those beliefs, theist, non-theist. That's the complexity of the question. No easy formula for this.
Yeah, because what if we had a, if this is even possible, an atheistic pro-life, pro-liberty, you know, all the things that we love, running for president next time against a Kamala Harris or a Joe Biden, who would you pick? You know,
those are the guys. Isn't that why you have party platforms, though?
What's that?
Isn't that why you have party platforms, though?
Yeah, I mean, that's always the hope, is that the party platform will anchor you to some degree. But obviously, our party platform doesn't seem to have a real strong hold on a lot of our Republicans in terms of which way they go with things sometimes.
How long did this... The Pope being excluded, how long did that last?
I think that was kind of it for him. I don't know if he ever ended up having any real influence, at least not in the Holy Roman Empire sense. I mean,
it was just that particular Pope. It wasn't...
Well, no, I mean, I think from then on, the Pope was kind of, you know, the Pope lost a lot of influence at that point. because they just said, who needs the Pope? It was up to that point, the Pope had a...
The Pope lost his influence in Germany?
Especially in Germany, yeah. Especially in Germany.
In Germany, he had no longer authority or power.
Yeah.
Before, he had influence over everybody, and now he just has influence over Catholics?
Yeah. I mean,
or is it the Pope... Kind of influence?
The Pope was a big political force for years, you know, just like the example he brought to mind about the, you know, he had to, at one point, the emperor was begging outside the door of the Pope, you know, and that power swung back and forth a lot, even during those years. I mean, at times, it seemed like the emperors had the upper hand, and at times it seemed like the Pope got the upper hand. But at this point, with all the various other religious groups now coming together, the Pope became sort of irrelevant. I don't know if they're the only ones. They do seem to have a lot of trouble because there was a Protestant Catholic divide going on there, for one thing, that I'm aware of.
but I mean, I was just reading that it said from then on they could, Protestants and the Catholics weren't continually fighting, and I thought, why didn't Ireland?
Yeah, mostly. Mostly. Okay. There's always exceptions, you know. Even the Augsburg Agreement, when we talked about how the Catholics and Lutherans had an agreement, but they didn't always keep it. You know, there's always, sinful man, there's always going to be disruptions. There's no perfection.
In the same way, I'm a fan of states' rights and limiting a centralized government's authority and power. I see an advantage to these nation states, the formation of all these nation states. Going back to the Tower of Babel and the division of languages,
yeah.
A serious restraint of evil in God's deliberate separation,
yes,
of those people.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm with you on that. That's one of the major building blocks of our nation is the federalism, the division of power amongst the states.
Yeah.
And then even within the states, you know, we have counties, whatever degree you can divide power.
And would love to see more autonomy in that regard.
Yeah.
In the whole Hamilton-Jefferson debates, I can see the argument on the other side.
Yeah.
For sure. There's economically, militarily, the defense of the nation, there's great advantages to a centralized government. But if that can be balanced with appropriate autonomy of the states, that would be ideal. But we see that getting stripped away more.
Yeah, we're seeing today is a strong movement toward a centralized federal government. And anybody that's not towing the line, like Florida, you know, if they're not following the COVID rules or something, you know, they're going to get the whip from the federal government. Even though there's no, they're claiming it's based on science, but it's not. It's based on you're not towing the line and following the federal government, and the government's going, that's right, I'm not. And I'm cheering for him. Well, I don't know how long that will last. Any other?
Allie had an interesting comment.
What was your comment, Allie?
I was saying, so at the end of this time, you have the Holy Roman Empire kind of breaking up, and you have the nobles kind of being more in charge of their place. Well, the noble, you really unite into a country, even though they are Germany. The next time that they're really united is by Hitler in World War II.
Yeah.
So I can kind of see that as the beginning of that conflict as well.
Yeah, there's always going to be some, there's always a temptation for a larger power to draw everybody in. You know, and again, you've got the advantages and disadvantages of that. You know, you think about the 13 original colonies, you know, united we stand, divided we fall. You know, that's the idea of unity. And yet, they kept their independence to some degree. That's one of the things that's made the United States, I think, a very successful experiment, they've called it sometimes, just because we do keep a bit of a balance between local versus federal. It's a hard thing to balance. Because you tend to want to tip one way or the other. All right.
So,
well,
Allie, help me out. There continued to be a division in all these.
In Germany, yeah.
Until Hitler?
he's the one who came up and united all the people into one cause and made them proud to be Germans.
So before that, Germany, how would you, what would you call those divisions? Territories?
Yeah, like they were technically one country, but it wasn't, they weren't patriotic. They didn't have that.
Nationalism?
Yeah, nationalism
okay.
that Hitler brought to them.
I see. Yeah.
The Germans. How many times has Germany gone through this, right?
Seeing that map is helpful.
Yeah.
For me to see how
yeah.
big swath of land surrounding Germany,
yeah.
and then Germany being fragmented into however many, what did you say, 100?
Yeah, oh, I don't know how many there were, but there, I tried to go backward and did the wrong thing. But yeah, that I thought that was interesting too, all the little fragments that that made up the country. Yeah. Yeah, I thought that was interesting too. Because that's the only country that's that fragmented. You know, I mean, you look at those little tiny fragments and look at the other countries, they're all like big, big masses, you know. So that was very telling. All right, let me wrap it up because I know we're wanting to get on with the service and hoping to be able to get it done before the snow hits. Father, we thank you for our time and pray that you would give us safe travel home today, give us a good service and a good time of fellowship. Thank you for this discussion and give us wisdom as we continue to wrestle through some of these issues that have been historical issues. We're not the first to have to deal with these things, but we have history to learn from and pray that we would indeed learn from our history. Pray in Christ's name. Amen. You're dismissed.